Hello and welcome to the Karate Priest Podcast. I'm your host, Father Daniel Duplantis. I'm a martial artist, musician, airman, and a priest of the Diocese of Houma Thibodeau. One of my other passions in life is teaching, especially teaching about the Catholic faith. Catholicism is a very deep faith. Jesus himself told Peter to put out into the deep for a catch. The most significant answers to life's most important questions often lie deep beneath the surface. Many people have questions about their faith. Through this podcast, my aim is to explore these questions and encounter incredible people along the way. Their stories show that God is constantly at work in our lives every single day, sometimes in the ordinary and sometimes in the extraordinary. Some of the topics treated in this podcast may be sensitive or controversial, but their discussion holds the key to truly living as God created us to live, which is to say that He created us to live in authentic freedom, loving Him above all else. Thank you for joining me on this journey of faith, and I hope you enjoy this podcast. Hey guys, and welcome back to the Karate Priest Podcast. I'm your host, Father Dan here, and today I'm joined by my producer, Todd Fisher, and we'll be discussing the war in Ukraine right now. So Todd, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Father Dan. Thanks for having me back, even though I'm technically on all the episodes, just not being heard.
Yes, Todd's always in the background doing the recording and does all the editing behind the scenes, and so yeah, great to have you here. We had you a few weeks ago with the joint episode that released on all of our podcasts.
Yeah, that did really well. Everybody seemed to really like that.
It was. I got a lot of good feedback on my end. I know Amber did as well. So glad to hear from yours too. So
we'll have to do that again sometime.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. But today will be this Ukraine conflict. Wow.
Yeah, we're talking about an episode to do, and I just mentioned, hey, maybe we should do something timely about this Ukraine conflict, because I thought maybe we could offer a little different slant than what people normally hear, particularly from a religious side of it.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, what's funny as well too, is with me, like, cause I'm a priest, but I'm also in the military, you know, there's really the two kind of perspectives that I look at this whole conflict. You know, I look at it from, you know, this is a military conflict. At the same time, there is a huge spiritual aspect that goes along with this. Ukraine is such a spiritual country. In many ways, it's known as one of the spiritual capitals of the world. I mean, Kiev is the home to the Ukrainian Orthodox and Ukrainian Catholic churches. And so, yeah, this really is a unique lens, I think, to offer about thoughts on this whole war.
I found a few statistics here about Ukraine. And it mentions that a large majority of Ukraine's population is Orthodox, with a significant minority of Ukrainian Catholics who worship, and maybe you can explain this to me, they worship with a Byzantine liturgy similar to that of the Orthodox, but are loyal to the Pope. What is that exactly? What does that mean?
Yeah, so this is actually a really cool thing that I got to experience about 5 years ago. So what happens let's kind of backtrack with the history a little bit. So in the early centuries of Christianity, you had these churches that sprang up, and we see this a lot, like in the book of Revelation, and even in like St. Paul's epistles, where he addresses specific churches. So he's addressing the church in Rome. He's addressing the church at Corinth, the church at Ephesus. So all of these places were local churches. And so really back in the early centuries, before like the papacy was such a prominent thing, it was always there. You know, it was given to Peter, and then Peter had successors after he passed away. And that succession was never lost. But what happened was in these Eastern churches, they were kind of more or less a little bit more independent in terms of how their rights formed and a little bit more of the polity. And that's kind of remained more the case with the Orthodox Church today than it has with the Western Latin churches, where you see these more distinct churches. So you have like the Russian Orthodox Church, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. What happens is Ukraine has the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, and with the Great Schism back in, I think it was 1054, with the Great Schism, you had several of these Orthodox churches, you had members who
who maintain their liturgical and all of their kind of cultural appropriations of their rites, but many of them wanted to remain in union with Rome because they acknowledged the fact that the papacy was really something Christ instituted. So there's the sense that, you know, they wanted to remain in union with the whole church, whereas most of the Orthodox Church ended up breaking away, and that's what we call the Great Schism between the East and the West, something that still exists to a great extent today. And so what happens is in countries like Ukraine and countries like Russia is you have their Orthodox Church, and then you have their Catholic Church, which is nearly identical in their liturgies. In fact, it would probably be very hard to distinguish between the two of them if you just walked into one of their churches and it didn't have Catholic or Orthodox on their signs. So prime example is 5 years ago, when I was in when I was doing my first summer of Air Force assignments, we did part of our chaplain candidate tour at Lackland Air Force Base. And while we were there, we attended a Ukrainian Orthodox Divine Liturgy. And then a few months later, in September, so this was 2 months after that, when I got to the seminary again, for the fall semester, we had a Ukrainian Catholic priest who came and did a Ukrainian Catholic Divine Liturgy at the seminary. Now, look, because I'd just seen the same thing, I just saw the one 2 months ago that was the Orthodox, they were identical liturgies. They were exactly the same. It was just one is in union with Rome and one was not. So for the Orthodox liturgy, I could not receive communion. So they have this kind of thing at the end of their divine liturgy where, you know, if you are baptized, but you're not an Orthodox, then you can receive some kind of blessed bread, but it's not the Eucharist. But then for the Ukrainian Catholic liturgy, it was at the seminary. It was a Catholic liturgy. And so I was able to receive communion for that. So that's kind of what happens with the situation between the Orthodox and the Catholics in Ukraine is their liturgies are nearly identical. It's just that for about 5 million Catholics in Ukraine, it's an actual Catholic liturgy, whereas the remainder of the country is mostly, again, the Orthodox faith.
Right, right. Also, it also says that the population includes smaller percentages of Protestants, Jews, and Muslims. So there's definitely a lot represented there, I think.
Right, but I think for the most part, they do fall. The majority of them are Orthodox. That's the thing. In that whole Mediterranean region, the Christian faith is very, very ancient. In fact, it spread kind of up from the Holy Land, up around the coast, you know, into Rome and then into Spain. You know, it kind of spread along those routes. And so for the most part, we would say that most of the Ukrainians religiously are closer to Catholics than they would be to Protestants. And so it's a more solidified kind of Orthodox faith. Now, President Zelensky is Jewish. So there is a heavy presence of Jewish as well. But for the most part, it seems like many of them are under that umbrella of Orthodox Christianity.
I'm curious, when a conflict like this breaks out, what is happening with the priest on the ground level during a crisis like this? I mean, church is still in session. Is he trying to keep the congregation together? What would happen in a wartime situation like this?
So what's happening, and I've been seeing a lot of articles from like Catholic sources on some of the things that, you know, my brother priests are doing over there. Yes, many of them are still celebrating sacraments. I've seen pictures and articles of priests who are celebrating mass, like Sunday liturgies, in bomb shelters. Kind of like me, they have these little travel mass kits that they're able to bring, and they're celebrating mass in these bomb shelters, you know, because I'm not sure if any of the churches have been hit by missiles or bombs, but they're trying as much as possible to continue that. I've seen a lot of pictures of couples still getting married, you know. There's been couples of pictures of couples getting married and then going straight into camouflage uniforms and going to fight together, you know. So what it seems like is in this situation, the priests are continuing to minister as best as possible, even if they're not per se military chaplains, you know. Again, this is happening on their home soil. So I'm sure at this point, you know, there's many priests who are directly celebrating sacraments, perhaps for their military, who are not chaplains in their military. But again, because Ukraine is such a religious country, I'm sure the priests there right now are very, very busy providing sacramental needs and just ministry needs in general for their people.
It doesn't seem like the Russians are paying attention to many rules right now, but I'm curious if you even know this. Are churches supposed to be protected during war like hospitals are? Is this like part of Geneva Conventions where there's certain things that are off limits that you just don't bomb?
I would imagine so. I mean, I can't say for certain, and I don't know all the rules really with as regards those things with Geneva, but I would imagine that, you know, simply out of a sake of human decency, places like churches and hospitals, schools would be off limits, you know, and that's the thing too. It seems like Russia is telling the people of Ukraine, like our fight is not with you, it's against the government. But at the same time, you know, we're hearing stories of hospitals being bombed, maternity wards, schools being attacked. You know, there was a theater where I think there were several hundred Ukrainians who were killed, and it was clearly marked with a sign that said children. And the reality is Russia is such a developed country with its military and its intelligence service that there really shouldn't be any excuse as to, you know, lack of intelligence about their targets. You know, they know what they're hitting, and, you know, they have such a developed military and such a developed intelligence that they really should. You know, there really is no excuse, you know, and so when we hear President Biden saying things like they're committing war crimes, I trust that intelligence, because especially our intelligence, too, in the United States, you know, we have fantastic intelligence. And so I think back to before the invasion happened, you know, this is just a few days before Russia invaded. There was an article I saw that said the United States is saying Russia is going to invade. And in being in the military and just kind of knowing like what our intelligence is capable of doing, if that's what U.S. intelligence was saying, then I pretty much knew that, oh yeah, that means they're really going to invade, because our intelligence wouldn't be saying that if they didn't have good reason to. That's the thing. I think the intelligence really leaves no excuse for the bombing of hospitals, schools, and things like that.
Right. You hear a lot on the news about the conscript army, and I think a lot of people in the general public don't understand what that is. Historically, conscript armies have been around a long time, and what conscript armies are is there's very high ranking and very low ranking.
Right.
And there's not much in between, where in the United States, we have a lot of ranks, a lot of people, a lot of different levels of chain of command. But I think historically conscript armies have just been a lot of low ranking soldiers that are kind of fodder for the war. So they have big high casualties and less experienced. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what we keep hearing, is that it seems like a lot of the Russian troops at this point are conscripts. And what I'm seeing a lot as well is there's a lot of dysfunction between exactly that chasm, as you just mentioned, of lower ranks and higher ranks. In fact, I just read an article earlier that there was one particular unit, I think a motorized rifle unit, that ran over its commander with a tank, like wow. Turned on their commander. And so, you know, if these aren't volunteers, and I think that's, you know, that's a huge point when you look at, you know, conscripts versus volunteers, is that volunteers are there because they want to be there. You know, conscripts are there because they've been conscripted. They have to be there. And so if you're looking at two different sources of motivation to fight, you know, yeah, I would imagine that there's a great chasm between, you know, the high ranking officers who have been in, who are, you know, decades long veterans of, you know, conflict for Russia versus these conscripts. Many of them are young. You know, I think there was one also who got captured in the early days of the fighting and he was crying. You know, they had him crying. He was able to call his family back in Russia and tell them he was okay, that he didn't want to be there, you know? So I think that's playing a huge part right now. You know, I think to throw conscripts against a country like Ukraine, who is fighting bitterly to defend its homeland, I think it's been a grave military miscalculation on Russia's part.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of the largest empires in the world have been conscript armies, and they've generally had high casualty count conflicts. But the Chinese have been like that. Even the Roman Empire was like that, conscript-based armies. So it's been something for a long time. I often wonder if the inexperienced conscript army is the reason why things like theaters or hospitals are being hit, because of the lack of experience with soldiers like that.
Yeah, perhaps. I think that could be a part of it. You know, if they're not, you know, Lord knows what kind of training did they have before they began this invasion?
You know,
did they go through their full series of boot camp, or, you know, or were they kind of rushed into training? And, you know, that's the thing is what's the nature of this conscription? I'm not too sure of.
Yeah. You know, naturally, I think everyone realizes there's a lot of political restraints on getting involved in something like this. Are there rules on religious involvement in conflicts like this, or at least with the humanitarian effort side?
So at least from a Vatican perspective, and again, I could really probably speak more to just like the Catholic Church side of things as opposed to religion in general. You know, at least when it comes to like the Vatican has a policy of neutrality. And that's because the Vatican's first priority when it comes to armed conflict is the pursuance of peace. And so with that, the Vatican has been very careful about the language it uses. It obviously condemns the crisis as a whole. It condemns the fact that there are two civilized nations that are at war with each other. And so the Vatican has been very careful to not point fingers. It condemns the conflict as a grave, I guess you could say grave or maybe rotten fruit of fallen humanity, you know, the fact that here we have, again, two civilized nations. But at the same time, the Vatican can send humanitarian aid. It will not send military aid because the reality is like the Vatican's only soldiers, you could say, are the Swiss guards, right? And their sole purpose is to protect the Pope, all right? Because remember, even Switzerland has a policy of neutrality, and that's why they offer their, you know, the Swiss guards to the papacy, is so that, you know, they have a kind of shared sense of neutrality. But yeah, like the Vatican itself is going to offer itself, and that's what it's doing now, is offering itself to help broker peace between the two sides. It wants to, first and foremost, play the role of mediator in regards to its relationship to both sides of any armed conflict.
Right. The Pope, he issued a comment recently. What did he say? Was he condemning the Ukraine? Condemn might be the wrong word. I might be picking the wrong thing.
Yeah, because that's
what the thing was too, the statement.
There's been several things he said. But for the most part, like he's I'm trying to find it on here. For him, really, it's again, he's condemning the fact that it is a war. You know, he hasn't condemned Russia, flat out. He hasn't condemned Putin. But it's more really just of a general sense of condemning war itself. Why in this day and age is there a need for that? Now, the big thing that the Pope did recently was he led a consecration of Russia and Ukraine and all of humanity to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. And that was actually yesterday for the Feast of the Annunciation, which was actually a really cool thing because it was, he invited his brother bishops around the world to join in this, and then also for their priests, their parishes. And so it's amazing how, you know, when you look at like church polity and especially in like the Latin church, when the Pope says, you know, we're going to consecrate Russia and Ukraine to the Immaculate Heart, and then that gets disseminated to the bishops, then to the priests, and to, you know, the individual sitting in the pew. We had so many people texting me earlier this week asking, you know, for the cathedral here in Houma, like, are we going to participate in this? Are we going to join in this as well? And, you know, we actually got the text through our diocesan liturgy office that was disseminated to the priests to how we're going to do the consecration. And so I've heard of great turnouts throughout the diocese here for that particular event. Whereas at St. Francis, we printed off the normal number of novena cards we would have for Friday daily mass. And we ran out right before mass. We had to make more copies because we were probably about 50 copies short, at least. We had that great of a turnout for people who wanted to participate in this consecration. So that's really like the main positions that the church will take in regards to conflict like this, is to first and foremost, like pray, you know, pray to them for the conflict, and then offer to broker peace in any way possible and provide humanitarian aid, as opposed to taking a particular political side.
Yeah, for sure. And what would you recommend just to any other Catholic in the world right now that wants to help? What can they do?
The biggest thing is prayer, you know, and we say that all the time and it sounds so cliche, but there's such a power in prayer. And, you know, especially in wartime in history, I think we've seen great fruits of prayer, especially the rosary. Oh, man, like this is a time to really turn to the rosary. And I think of so many rosary miracles associated with war, like the Battle of Lepanto, you know, in the Middle Ages, where they had the successful defense against the Turkish invasion. And that was attributed to the rosary. And then also in World War II, there is a rosary miracle in Japan, in Hiroshima, actually, that, you know, when Hiroshima was bombed, there was a house of Jesuit priests that was completely untouched by the bombing. And it was in the middle of Hiroshima. Everything else around it is completely destroyed by the atomic bomb. But this house that the Jesuits were living in was protected, and they attribute that to the rosary. They said they prayed the rosary every day of the war, and they attribute them being spared from the bomb to the rosary. So prayer is huge. And then, you know, or just, you know, for Catholics, you know, maybe because we're in the season of Lent for almsgiving, people wanting to donate to various organizations who are providing humanitarian aid, I think would be great. I want to caution people against, you know, we hear President Zelensky calling for people to come and fight. And I really want to caution people with that, because I've had somebody text me and ask me if what they thought about that. And I said, look, I said, it's not as simple of like, rah, rah, let's go fight, you know, because the reality is you have to take into account international conventions, Geneva Convention, Hague Convention, that there are certain protections in place for civilians. And once you enter the, you know, once you become a combatant, even if you go and volunteer in Ukraine, you become a combatant, there are certain, like you have now changed statuses under the Geneva Convention. You are now crossing so many international laws that it's really not just as simple of I'm going to sign up to fight. I really wouldn't recommend it. I would not at this point, you know, from a church perspective, like we really need to rely on our diplomacy. Right. And even as a military chaplain, I really, really do not recommend, you know, people going to Ukraine to sign up to fight. You know, I think our governments are doing whatever they can to help Ukraine defend itself. But again, there's so much red tape you cross when you just sign up and say, I want to go fight. And so I really, really do want to caution people with that as well.
It seems really sad to see what's happening. You know, me, I'm a product of the 80s. So I grew up with the threat of nuclear war every day. You know, when I was 14 years old, that's all that was on the news every day was we're one day closer to, you know, nuclear midnight. Like it was all that was on our mind was this, you know, spread of the red threat and, you know, us against them. And that's what we grew up with. It was kind of a World War III that we were promised that we never got in a way. That sounds terrible to say, but it's really fascinating to me to see this start to happen again, and to see Russia go into the second largest, I believe the Ukraine is the second largest country in Europe after France. I might be wrong on that. Someone told me once that Ukraine was the biggest, and since then I've heard that maybe France is.
Either way, it's up there. It's one of the largest European countries. Yeah.
Yeah. And to see this happen and see no one in the world want to come to their aid is really sad to me. But yeah, the rest of the world is super cautious because an entry into this conflict could mean World War III. So right. Instead, now we're seeing this conflict play out on the news with lots of dead children and lots of, you know, dead women and pregnant mothers and, you know, it's terrible what we're seeing, and everyone stands back and stays away from it. And I just wonder when people will start to feel guilty about that, about not intervening or trying to do something, or whether, you know, is that loss of life, those people, is that worth it to avoid a World War III? Would there even be a World War III? I think there's a lot of very interesting things I think people will look at and analyze with this in the years and the decades to come about whether this was right or wrong to enter into it or not.
Yeah, I think, you know, and that's the thing with the alliances you see is, you know, Ukraine is not a member of NATO. And if it was, we would have an obligation to send troops if you know, if they were a member of NATO and this had happened. And that's why Zelensky was saying, you know, if we were a member of NATO, this would never have happened. And you know, that's probably true, because if they were a member of NATO, would Russia really want to take on all of Western Europe, the United States, Canada, and even though Australia is not in NATO, at least to say, like, you know, our allies in the Pacific as well, you know? And that's what, you know, that's basically what happens and kind of how World War III, I think, would be triggered, is the invasion of a NATO nation. And this is why people are so, you know, concerned of, well, okay, if he's doing this to Ukraine, is he going to do this to other former Soviet bloc states that are much smaller than Ukraine, you know, like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania? That's where I think would be a huge mistake, is if, you know, which invading Ukraine, I think, is a mistake anyway. But for Russia to invade any of these countries would trigger an automatic response from NATO. You know, so that's the thing, is other countries are providing whatever aid they can, even militarily, to Ukraine without actually sending troops. You know, I think there is such a great fear of sparking a nuclear war, because that's everyone's saying it. You know, everybody knows that World War III would be a nuclear war, mm-hmm. you know, and we've heard Putin say he's putting his nuclear troops on heightened alert. And, you know, and that's the thing, is would he actually do it? I'm not sure, you know, because the reality is, and I heard this quote in a movie recently, and I think it's a great quote. If it's not on the table, it's not a deterrent. And so what he's doing is he's putting his deterrent on the table. And so that's what's concerning here, you know.
Well, you know what you said about NATO, an organization, but we're all, you know, there's people there that are members of the human race.
Well, yeah.
If we took away, you know, the cities and states and governments and all these things are important, but when you boil it all down, it comes down to people. And
right.
we're not helping people because of an organization that says that we can't. And that's
right.
that part that I think is wrong.
Yeah. And this is the thing too. And you know, at least for the United States, our country has a history, and it's actually not a recent history. This has been, you know, for us, at least in the last century and a half, probably, where the United States tends to not want to get involved in armed conflict if there's nothing to be gained from it. You know, we have a position as a government that's really a what's in it for me attitude. I mean, look at World War One and World War Two. How did the United States get involved? World War One, we didn't get involved until 1917, I think it was, when the Lusitania was attacked. Like, it wasn't until we had one of our ships was attacked that we got involved.
Right.
We stayed and we watched. And then what happened with World War Two? The rest of Europe is at war, you know. In Europe and North Africa, the United States did not get involved until what happened? Pearl Harbor was attacked. So U.S. territory was attacked, and we finally got involved. So yeah. You see, it's we really tend to sit back and prefer to not get involved unless there's something in it for us, or we ourselves are attacked. You know.
Yeah.
So look, same thing, and this is a more recent case. Why did we get involved in Afghanistan? Because we got attacked on our home soil.
Yeah.
So you see, it's the United States is not a preemptively striking country. That's just not in our nature as a military, which I think is a great policy. You know, I think it's a, you know, the reason why we call our military the Department of Defense, as opposed to it used to being called the War Ministry, because we, the United States, for the most part, we act very defensively. We're, as opposed to what Russia is doing. And this is, I think, a comment the Pope did make. The Pope called this an act of aggression. You know, the United States does not have a history of committing aggressive warfare,
right.
To the sense of, like, we are the ones to initiate conflict. You know, there's usually we wait till our assets are attacked first. And again, you look at history that way. And that's why I think the United States is very hesitant to even send planes to NATO allies, who, like for Poland, you know, who wants to send MiGs to Ukraine, you know,
right.
it's a very, very fine line that we're trying to walk right now.
Right. Well, it's extraordinary to see it play out on television and what happens next and how it will end. I can't imagine that Putin will withdraw all his troops back to Russia without winning this war. I think one way or another, he's determined to get this country.
Right, because what happens if you just turn around and say, you know, oh, wait, yep, what? Because you admit you messed up.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you know, what's going to happen, I think what almost has to happen is there's going to have to be a great sense of forgiveness, you know, on to forgive Russia, you know, and that's the thing too. I think the, you know, we see the Pope, we see President Biden, making comments of like, you know, we are not at war with the Russian people. You know, there are many Russians who do not condone this conflict. So for us, I think there's going to have to be a great sense of forgiveness and a willingness to move beyond what has happened so that the world can heal.
Right. I hope so. Those are fitting words to end the podcast by, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. You know, so I think above all else, continuing to pray for, you know, for a peaceful resolution. And then once resolution is met, forgiveness, man, I mean, that's the biggest word I think that's going to have to come forth from this is forgiveness.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Yep. So, well, Todd, yeah, great discussion on this and really appreciate you coming out. And you want to tell our listeners about your podcast as well? Give a plug in for yours.
Well, it might be in our closing credits. I can't remember, but yeah, my podcast is Quest with Todd. So go find that. I talk about all kinds of things about science, technology, religion, spirituality, you know, great interviews with people that do extraordinary things. It's always a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I know you just had your, you had a expedition recently to the Holy Land looking forward to hearing more about that.
Yeah, an expedition to the Dead Sea. We're the first people to map the seafloor of the Dead Sea. And I can't go into too much of what we were looking for yet because I want to make a big reveal about our findings, but we found some stuff that's really extraordinary and may support some biblical history. So
that's incredible. I'm looking forward to
tease everyone with that.
Yes, that's always great. Teasers are fantastic. So again, for any of the listeners, if you want to hear more about that in that development, go ahead and give Todd a follow on his podcast, The Quest with Todd Fisher. And so with that, again, Todd, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, we'll do it again.
Very good. And for the rest of our listeners, thank you, Todd. For the rest of our listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we will see y'all next time.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of The Karate Priest. If you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and like The Karate Priest on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and subscribe to the YouTube channel. If you're ever in South Louisiana, come visit me at the Cathedral of St. Francis de Sales in Houma. If you have any questions or comments about the show, you can also email me at thekaratepriest@gmail.com. Your questions are welcomed and may be used in future episodes. May the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit come down on you and remain with you forever. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for the International Association of Metatomics at metatomics.org or find us on social media for other unique content.